The predator you could see, you could protect against. Not so the snake hiding in the grass. We continue, accordingly, to fear those risks that lurk out of sight. We fear the threat posed by nuclear energy, even though the only American nuclear accident, Three Mile Island, killed no one, but pay little mind to the act of driving, even as more than 30,000 Americans die in car crashes every year. We fret about cancer from cell phones as we drag on cigarettes. Rain is so familiar as to feel benign. The floodwaters may rise, but you can see the water approaching. Its impact feels manageable. And most of the time, we manage it quite well. The other hazards, earthquakes, volcanoes, landslides, emerge from out of nowhere. They are erratic, invisible, a sudden disruption to the earth. Not so rain. Beyond the psychological factors are the physical ones. For all natural disasters, smaller events occur much more often than larger ones, with the largest events rarest still. Look at the earthquakes recorded throughout the world this year, or across all of California's history, or even just the aftershocks of one main shock, and you'll find the same distribution of sizes. For every magnitude 7, there will be 10 magnitude 6 events, 100 magnitude 5 events, 1,000 magnitude 4 events, 10,000 magnitude 3 events, and 100,000 magnitude 2 events. For floods, a similar pattern applies, though statistics are unique to each drainage system. In any river, we can measure the flow rate, how much water passes a given point in 1 second. Most of the time, it is low. When a typical storm hits, it goes up slightly. Every few years, a really big storm strikes and it goes up further. If it rains on a lot of accumulated snow, even greater flow results. When all the factors line up, they trigger a catastrophic flood. Just like earthquakes, the small ones are common, the big ones rare. Hydrologists measure flow rate every day. They plot out daily rates for many years. They can say that a stream has a high probability of exceeding the low value in any given year, a moderate probability of exceeding the high value, and a very low probability of exceeding the very high value. The flow rate that has only a 1% chance of being reached at any time in 1 year is called the 100-year flood. You can push out the distribution curve, assuming that this relationship of large to small will continue, and estimate the 1,000-year flood, the flood that has only a 1 in 1,000 chance of happening this year. That's a low probability, of course, but with thousands of rivers, each receiving different storms, we see a 1,000-year flood somewhere in the world most years. The 1861-62 flood was the worst of many very devastating floods in California in the 19th century. By the early 20th century, the Great River Delta of the Central Valley had been contained by levees. Dams were built in the Sierra foothills to save water for irrigation and to reduce further flooding. After one rainstorm in 1938, dropped 32 inches of rain in 5 days in the mountains around Los Angeles, putting one-third of the Los Angeles basin underwater, the demand for flood control in the southern part of the state was too great to ignore. The streams in Los Angeles were lined with concrete to hasten water's passage to the ocean. Through man's ingenuity and engineering, the floods were stopped. Or so it seemed. What the engineers had done was manage smaller floods. The dams, levees, and concrete channels could accommodate 100-year floods, or in a few cases, the 200-year flood. But however big a flood control system you build, a larger flood is always possible. In fact, it is almost certain if you wait long enough. At some point in the future, another winter like 1861-62 will come along, overflowing dams and breaking through levees, flooding potentially millions of homes. It's not a question of if, but when. That's where my team and I stepped in. In 2008, just as we were releasing the last phase of the San Andreas earthquake scenario, we undertook the modeling of a massive flood for California. Our aim was for something like 1862, although modeling constraints made it a bit smaller. The program was called Arc Storm. The AR stands for atmospheric rivers, the meteorological phenomena behind the big storms, and the K stood for 1,000, to suggest that we were looking at rare big storms. In fact, the K was somewhat arbitrary, but it allowed us to use cool graphics of arcs. We estimated from geologic records that storms the size of 1861-62 happened once every century or two, much the same rate as the big San Andreas earthquakes. The flooding we saw was big enough to overwhelm existing flood control systems and thus return California to flooding levels much like those of the 19th century, before any such controls were in place. We were astonished to see how much more damaging Arc Storm was compared to the shakeout earthquake. Using the same methodology wherever possible, we found that 24% of the buildings in California would be damaged, and that the losses to flood were four times greater than for the earthquake, with almost $1 trillion in damages. But even more surprising than the findings themselves was the reaction to our study when it was released in 2010. Many officials simply refused to accept it. Where the shakeout scenario had been embraced by emergency managers, many flood managers dismissed out of hand the possibility of that much damage. They knew what a flood was. They had managed many floods in the past. They wanted to believe that their engineering solutions could not be exceeded, so they ignored our findings. The scenario found more traction on local levels among smaller regional organizations. It was easier for them to imagine losing their communities. Which brings us back to the psychological dimension. As disaster scientists, we knew that floods cause less emotional distress than earthquakes, so we shouldn't have been too surprised. But I thought that when presented with the evidence, cities would say, "We need to change our priorities." Instead, the data was largely rejected because it didn't conform to the emotional response of the emergency managers, people who, like all of us, are more afraid of the unseen. Psychologists might say they were acting on confirmation bias, critical of data that didn't match their point of view. This inability to accept the possibility of extreme flooding events increases the risk for people across the United States, and indeed the world. The standard method for estimating how bad a flood could be requires using recorded history. The length of that history, what the hydrologists call the period of record, rarely exceeds 100 years in the United States because the first stream gauge was invented only in the late 19th century. That means that old floods, such as those in 1861-62, aren't integrated into predictions, even when we know about them. Across the country, people build houses and businesses in floodplains based on insufficient data, creating greater risk with each new construction project. The situation is potentially even more perilous today. The additional heat in our atmosphere, which has over the last century warmed average global temperature by 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit, translates into extra energy, contributing to more extreme storms. The assumption underlying any thousand-year flood is that the future will be similar to the past, what scientists call stationarity. With several thousand-year storms happening in just a decade in communities such as Charleston, South Carolina, and Houston, Texas, the phrase "stationarity is dead" has come to be pronounced at more than a few hydrology conferences and workshops. When one-third of the taxable land of California was destroyed in 1862, California had 400,000 residents. It now has almost 100 times more people, all still at risk from a future flood, and almost none of them know it. Chapter 5, Finding Faults. Tokyo, Yokohama, Japan, 1923. If this were not hell, where would hell be? Anonymous survivor of the 1923 Kanto earthquake. Earthquakes are as central to Japan, its history, and its culture as Mount Fuji or the Emperor. With a frequency of earthquakes three times that of California's, Japan has been devastated by earthquakes and their resulting tsunamis repeatedly through its history. Japanese mythology holds that Namazu, a giant black catfish buried underground, is responsible for earthquakes. Woodcuts depicting the Earthshaker are widely made and sold. Typhoons and lightning have patron deities. But earthquakes alone have been attributed to Namazu's malevolence, tamed only by a Shinto god. One of the deadliest earthquakes ever to ravage Japan was the 1923 Kanto earthquake of magnitude 7.9 that destroyed most of Tokyo and Yokohama and killed over 140,000 people. It occurred as Japan was transitioning from a traditional isolated culture to a player on the world stage, and the nation's response to the earthquake reflected that dichotomy. The Japanese Empire had maintained sovereignty over its islands for more than 1,000 years, secure in the knowledge of their special place on Earth. The Emperor was considered a semi-divine figure, descended from the sun goddess, and a mediator for the Japanese people with the celestial world. The Shogun, officially acting in the Emperor's name, was the actual ruler. The emperor had, over the centuries, become a primarily symbolic figure. Japan's cultural and philosophical understanding of the world was influenced by Confucian scholarship from China. The oldest Chinese book, the I Ching, written more than 3,000 years ago, is a foundational text for Chinese and Japanese philosophy alike. Confucius studied the I Ching and wrote extensive commentaries on it. In the Warring States period, around 250 BC, the philosopher Zhou Yan developed the school of naturalists, also called the school of Yin Yang, from ideas in the I Ching. It explained the universe as dependent on the interplay of essential forces, the Yang, male, light, air, hot, and the Yin, female, dark, earth, cold, acting through five elements, water, fire, wood, metal, and earth. The ideas of the Yin-Yang school were integrated with Confucianism by Dong Zhongshu, an advisor to the Han Dynasty emperor in the 2nd century BC, creating a philosophy that would guide the Chinese imperial government for 2,000 years and strongly influenced Japan. His book, Luxuriant Dew of the Spring and Autumn Annals, described a world in which the celestial, human, and natural spheres are interconnected, with each having to maintain a balance between the opposing forces. An imbalance in the human sphere would be echoed in the natural, resulting in natural disaster. Dong Zhongshu's writings emphasized the role of the emperor in connecting the spheres, and he developed guidelines for the emperor's behavior to stave off disasters. If the emperor was too autocratic and would not allow his ministers their proper role in the functioning of government, typhoons would strike the empire in an excess of yang. If the emperor became too weak, if the ministers usurped the roles that properly belonged with the emperor, or if women entered government, the too powerful yin would cause the earth to rise up and overpower the sky, leading to earthquakes. These views were so completely absorbed into Japanese culture that as early as AD 675, the Japanese government had a bureau to provide advice on yin-yang balance. With the first arrival of Westerners in the 17th century, the Japanese perceived a threat to their way of life. And so, in 1635, to restore harmony, the shogun prohibited any foreigners from living in Japan on pain of death. That edict and Japanese isolation persisted for the next two centuries. The nation's traditional views remained entrenched, even as the Enlightenment took hold in the West. Up through the 19th century, it was accepted that benevolent governments would demonstrate their cosmic rightness by a lack of natural disasters. But as the historian and professor of Asian studies at Penn State, Gregory Smits, noted, when divergence between cosmic moral principles and the state of government increased, strange atmospheric phenomena, crop failures, epidemics, earthquakes, and other natural disasters became the concrete manifestations of cosmic displeasure. Thus, the Japanese, like every human society before and since, resisted the notion that earthquakes, famines, and volcanoes could strike at random times. Patterns were sought, meanings inferred. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, where individuals have a personal relationship with their God, disasters were seen as the result of individual choices to sin. In the Japanese world, social harmony and community were prized over the individual. Consequently, those same disasters were attributed to societal failures. In the mid-19th century, just as California was coping with its massive floods, Japan was struggling to fend off a wave of dangerous ideas. The isolation that had protected Japanese society for centuries came apart when, in 1853, Commodore Perry of the U.S. Navy forced his way into Japan. He sailed gunboats into Tokyo Harbor, demanding that Japan open itself to trade with the West. The ruling lords were shamed by their powerlessness, their inability to oppose Perry without a navy of their own. The Japanese had no choice but to confront a radically different view of their place in the universe. Within a decade, the ruling structure that comprised a shogun and hundreds of feudal lords was toppled in what is known as the Meiji Restoration. The emperor was restored to governing power, no longer just a ceremonial leader. With a group of close advisors, the Meiji emperor took over foreign policy for Japan, rejecting the isolationism of the shogun before him. They saw in the humiliation by Commodore Perry the need to learn from the West. The Americans' iron warships, cannons, and guns had rendered the great fighting skills and personal discipline of the samurai irrelevant. The emperor and his advisors vowed to ensure that Japan could build their own guns and warships, that they would never again be so humiliated. To create an industrial society that could rival the West's, the Meiji emperor understood that Japan needed to reach outside itself. He sought out young European scientists and engineers, luring them to Japan with offers of funding and students. One of these emigres was an English geologist named John Milne. Born in 1850 in Liverpool, Milne had studied a range of subjects, from mathematics, surveying, and engineering, to geology and theology, financing some of his education by playing piano in pubs. He went to King's College and then, having decided to pursue a career as a mining engineer, to the Royal School of Mines in London. He clearly enjoyed travel, for in just a few years, he participated in exploratory expeditions to Europe, Iceland, Canada, and the Sinai. At the age of 25, he accepted an offer to go to Japan, where he would have an appointment as a professor of mining and geology at the Imperial College of Engineering in Tokyo. Prone to seasickness, he traveled overland through Scandinavia, Russia, Central Asia, and China, along a route that would later be used for the Trans-Siberian Railway. He arrived in Tokyo on March 8, 1876. That night, he experienced his first earthquake. As evidenced by his eclectic fields of study, Milne's interests were varied. He documented his observations of geology and botany during his crossing of Eurasia in his 1879 book, Across Europe and Asia. He studied the aboriginal people of Japan, the Ainu, traveling to the northern island of Hokkaido. While there, he met and married his wife, Tone Horikawa, the daughter of the abbot of a Buddhist monastery. Many years later, he married her again in a church in Tokyo, in a ceremony that would be recognized by the British government. Tone worked alongside Milne as a geologist. It was in his study of earthquakes that Milne's legacy was enshrined. Since the Enlightenment, Europeans had devoted themselves to a wide range of scientific endeavors. But with few earthquakes to observe, there weren't many researchers applying scientific rigor to the subject. It was in Japan that Milne and his fellow engineers at the Imperial College began trying to measure the earthquakes they were feeling, and in so doing, created the field of modern seismology. The Japanese islands are formed by the ongoing collision of four tectonic plates. The Eurasian plate to the west is colliding with the Pacific Ocean plate to the northeast and the Philippine Sea plate to the southeast, with a sliver of the North American plate caught in between. The collision between these four plates has pushed up the two plates to the west, the Eurasian and North American plates, creating the islands of Japan themselves, not to mention the magma that forms volcanoes, such as Mount Fuji. Subduction zones such as these have the highest rate of earthquakes of all the types of plate boundaries. They are under higher stress because the plates are pushing into each other instead of pulling apart or grinding alongside each other, which allows for greater friction with a larger percentage of the energy released in earthquakes. The complications resulting from the collision of four plates, not just two, mean that Japan's earthquakes tend to be distributed throughout the islands, not just at the plate boundary. Japan has more people at risk from earthquake shaking than anywhere else in the world. It was here that John Milne set about his study. He was curious about the earthquakes he felt and began looking for ways to record them. After a major earthquake damaged the port city of Yokohama in February 1880, Milne, two other Englishmen, and their Japanese colleagues formed the world's first seismological organization, the Seismological Society of Japan. One of their initial steps was to develop a precision seismograph based on a horizontal pendulum. The core principle is to suspend a large mass so that when the ground starts to move, the mass will stay where it was. A pen connected to the mass, writing on paper affixed to the ground, will show the differential movement between the ground and the mass. Modern seismometers still suspend a mass, but they use an electrical feedback system to create a digital record of the motion. With it, the first systematic catalog of earthquake locations and sizes could be constructed. That year, Milne's student, Seike Sakia, became the first person anywhere to be named a professor of seismology. He was also named head of the world's first seismology department at the University of Tokyo. With all these firsts, new instruments, new data, new researchers, the field of seismology quickly flourished. But the seismologists found, as they have continued to find, that the most significant advances spring from the most interesting earthquakes. Unlike other scientists, seismologists are in no position to create their own experiments. In 1891, the magnitude 8 Mino Owari earthquake offered fodder for early seismologists. The fault it occurred on was not part of the boundary between the three tectonic plates that lay offshore, but was rather a secondary inland fault. This fault came up to the surface of the earth, offsetting streams and roads. Studying that feature, Milne was the first to hypothesize a relationship between earthquakes and faults. He had the causality reversed, conjecturing that the earthquake had broken the fault. It would be decades before scientists realized that it was the movement along the fault itself that caused earthquakes. Another student of Milne's, Fusakichi Omori, used the Mino Owari earthquake to recognize and quantify the largest non-random component of earthquake behavior, aftershocks. When one earthquake happens, other earthquakes become more likely. The movement on a fault stresses everything around it, creating new irregularities, concentrations of stress. Subsequent earthquakes will result to relieve those new stresses. Because those earthquakes are expected and are a direct result of the preceding quake, we call them aftershocks. Omori studied the aftershocks of the Mino Owari earthquake and showed that their number drops off with time and that the pattern can be described with a simple equation. If there are 1,000 aftershocks on the first day, there will be 1,000 divided by 2, or 500, on the second day, and 1,000 divided by 3, or 333, on the third day. The tenth day will see 1,000 divided by 10, or 100 aftershocks, and the hundredth day will see 1,000 divided by 100, or 10 aftershocks. This means there is a very quick drop-off, but then a very long tail. The 99th day will have 1,000 divided by 99, or 10.101 aftershocks. So you can see that day 99 and day 100 are very similar. In 1991, on the centenary of the 1891 earthquake that Omori studied, Japanese seismologists showed that the rate of earthquakes around that fault was still following the decay pattern that Omori had discovered 100 years earlier. Soon after the Mino Owari earthquake in 1895, Milne returned to Great Britain with his wife Tone. He built similar seismographs on the Isle of Wight, installing them in multiple locations. Communicating with his Japanese colleagues, he was able to show that some of the movements being recorded in England were caused by Japanese earthquakes. With this observation began the field of global seismology. Back in Japan, Fusakichi Omori was named chairman of the seismology department after Sakiya's death in 1896. He expanded the staff and students. Instrumental seismology was up and running, with the Japanese leading the way. When the great earthquake on the northern part of the San Andreas Fault destroyed San Francisco in 1906, the Japanese emperor sent aid. Professor Omori himself went to California to provide his scientific expertise and learn from the event. Because of anti-Asian sentiments in California, he was mistreated when he arrived, even assaulted on the street. It is fortunate for all of us that he persisted. His work with scientists at the University of California, Berkeley, helped bring the pursuit of seismology to the United States. Milne had connected the occurrence of earthquakes with faults that could be seen at the surface. A decade later, a student of Omori's, Akatsune Imamura, tried to further quantify the spatial patterns of earthquakes. Luckily for him, the spatial distribution of earthquakes is much more predictable than the time of their occurrence. Going over Japanese history, Imamura saw a pattern of repeating earthquakes under the Tokyo-Yokohama metropolitan area. He worried about what a major earthquake would do to the newly urbanized area. When an earthquake moves on a fault, every point on the fault's surface produces shaking. If the fault is vertical, as with the San Andreas, the concentration of shaking might be represented on the Earth's surface as a line. The shaking generated on the fault radiates outward from that line, away from the fault, dying off with distance. We therefore see a linear pattern of shaking. If the fault is more horizontal than vertical, the case with the main fault and subduction zones, then the area of strong shaking will be wider. It might be represented on a map, not as a line, but as an area, and it can encompass an entire city. Imamura saw that previous earthquakes had shaken all of what was now Greater Tokyo and Yokohama. The region had since grown rapidly to a combined population of 4 million people, supporting the nation's new industrialization program. More than half of the inhabitants had arrived in the preceding 2 decades, with many living in crowded, poorly constructed buildings. Much of the land was soft sediment, and scientists had already recognized that earthquake shaking was worse in such soils. Imamura realized that a very large earthquake in such conditions would be devastating. He particularly worried about the fires that could be triggered and potentially grow too large to fight. Both of the very big earthquakes that had hit large, dense cities up to that point, the 1755 magnitude 8.7 Lisbon earthquake and the 1906 magnitude 7.8 San Francisco earthquake, had produced firestorms large enough to wipe the cities out. Imamura knew the history of these other earthquakes and saw the potential for a similar conflagration in the packed-together wooden houses of the new Tokyo. He prepared an analysis estimating the impacts of such an earthquake and the resulting fires, publishing it in a relatively obscure journal in 1906, just after the fires that had destroyed San Francisco. He estimated that between 1 and 200,000 people would die. A popular Tokyo newspaper took up the story, trumpeting the most sensational parts and proclaiming, without his permission, "Imamura says Tokyo will be destroyed." This generated public fear, and Omori, the director of the seismology department at the University of Tokyo, was furious. He publicly castigated Imamura and wrote his own article explaining why Tokyo would not suffer a major earthquake for centuries. The public humiliation outraged Imamura. He and Omori rarely spoke again. Education in science during the Meiji Restoration had helped shift the general understanding of earthquakes as physical phenomena rather than spiritual manifestations, just as the development of natural philosophy in late 18th century and 19th century Europe helped spark a similar evolution in thought. But for both cultures, folk traditions and emotional aversions were not so easily overcome. The Meiji Emperor passed away in 1912, and his son, the Taisho Emperor, ascended the chrysanthemum throne. The Taisho Emperor had a history of significant physical and neurological ailments, having contracted cerebral meningitis soon after his birth. His condition continued to deteriorate throughout his reign, and he wasn't seen in public after 1919. By 1921, his son Hirohito was named the prince regent, taking on his father's duties. In August 1923, the government entered an even more uncertain stage with the death of its prime minister. In his classic Chinese text, Luxuriant Dew of the Spring and Autumn Annals, Dong Zhongshu had given specific advice to the Han emperor about the mistakes that would create an excess of yin energy and cause earthquakes. The most common was the impending death of the emperor. To the Japanese, for whom the shogun had filled the leadership role of the emperor for centuries, both emperor and prime minister could be seen as sources of yang energy. A feeble emperor and a dead prime minister would have seemed a precise enactment of the causes of earthquakes. On September 1st, 1923, at 11:58 a.m., an earthquake began that in every sense shook the foundation of Japanese society. A sub-horizontal fault lying under Tokyo and Yokohama began to move. The rock above the fault surface, an area about 40 miles wide and 80 miles long, jolted to the south. Unlike an earthquake on a vertical fault, every location situated above the fault area was literally on the earthquake. Yokohama sat atop the fault, with Tokyo just beyond it. So all the 4 million people of these two cities received some of the strongest shaking the earth can produce. Many of those people had returned to their homes for the noon meal and were cooking over open flame stoves. The stoves toppled and fires started, just as Imamura had predicted 16 years earlier. Imamura himself was at his office at the University of Tokyo. As his building shuddered and roof tiles cascaded down, he did as all seismologists would in the same situation. He pulled out his watch and timed the arrival of different types of shaking. Later analysis has shown that the Earth produced energy for about 40 seconds as the fault break that had begun at the western edge of the fault worked its way east. The seismic waves would have bounced around with a sort of echoing effect, causing shaking in Tokyo for even longer. And that was before the aftershocks began. In great earthquakes of this size, it feels like the shaking goes on forever. Within minutes of the initial earthquake, fires had started across Tokyo and Yokohama. Large aftershocks in the first 10 minutes, some above magnitude 7, impeded efforts to control the flames. People tried, but as the fires raged, they were left with no choice but to flee. This mass exodus clogged the streets. Survivors told stories of being trapped for hours, unable to move. A house of courtesans had prevented the women from fleeing, afraid they would run away and not return, leading to more than 100 women burning to their death within. Many drowned in the Sumida River after jumping in to escape approaching flames. More than 40,000 people took refuge at a large open space at the Hanzhou Military Clothing Depot. Intense fire can create its own atmospheric conditions and wind storms. Called fire tornadoes, or translated from Japanese, dragon twists, the heated air rising off a fire hits turbulent wind conditions, forming a whirlwind of fire that spreads the destruction faster and farther. Dragon twists were spawned across Tokyo. One bore down on the Hanzhou Clothing Depot. Only 2,000 of the 40,000 huddled within survived. Many were burned alive, while others suffocated in the superheated, deoxygenated air. An anonymous description of this destruction asked, "If this were not hell, where would hell be?" The final tally suggested almost complete destruction of the metropolitan area. The imperial family was spared because they were not in residence at the time of the earthquake. But for everyone else, their lives were torn apart. In Yokohama, more than 80% of the buildings were destroyed. In Tokyo, about 400,000 buildings, including the houses of 60% of the population, were lost. The death toll was at least 140,000 people. Faced with this level of destruction, the government leader of a traditional Japan would have taken personal responsibility. Resignation, perhaps even seppuku, would be considered. The original Confucian classic by Deng Zhongshu provided directions for how the emperor should issue a self-criticism after a disaster and begin the process of correction. Almost immediately after the Ansei earthquake of 1855, which also damaged Tokyo, Namazue, catfish picture prints, began to appear in hastily printed anonymous broadsheets. These were populist attacks on the government, accusing them of causing the earthquakes, and they contributed to the shogun's downfall. But with the 1923 quake, the prime minister had died of natural causes just a week prior. The emperor hadn't been seen in public for 4 years, owing to his ill health. A weakness in the masculine side of government would have been readily apparent, and yet there was no leadership left to assign themselves the blame. Japan had, to an extent, progressed beyond its strictly traditional views. The nation was quickly evolving into a modern industrial society, with many of its citizens having by now been educated in the sciences. Seismology remained a rapidly developing field. And so two opposing views of the earthquake were at odds, that it was caused by an imbalance of yin-yang forces, and that it was a consequence of geologic factors. Clusters of the society would likely have responded differently, depending on their education and background. Admiral Yamamoto Gonahioe had been asked to form a government after the death of his predecessor on August 24th, but that government was still in discussion when the earthquake hit. He was installed on September 2nd, the next day. With the devastation of the cities nearly total and confusion abundant, he and others in government could surely see that it wouldn't take much for an uprising against the government to begin. In the face of loss and failure, no less a failure of this magnitude, we often turn to blame. We have a deep-seated aversion to having our missteps exposed, and we look for ways to avoid it. Blame provides an emotional outlet. It can also, in the wrong hands, be used as an explicit ruse to divert attention away from oneself. Because of Japan's self-imposed isolation from the outside world, foreigners, gaijin, or outside persons, held a status in early 20th century Japan that could be described as less than human. Of foreigners, the Koreans and Chinese had the most contact with Japan, with more dignity afforded the Chinese, perhaps because of the influence of Confucianism and Taoism on Japanese culture. The Koreans, meanwhile, had been subjected over many centuries to raids by both Japanese pirates and more official Japanese seamen, finally were conquered and colonized by Japan in 1910. As a colonial conquest, Korean workers were brought over to Japan to staff the demands of modernization, but they were denied a path to Japanese citizenship. Citizenship in Japan is carried out through patrilineal lines, recognizing each Japanese child as a descendant of the emperor. Koreans had no place in this scheme. As the leaderless government struggled to respond to the destruction of their capital, and fires continued to rage across the city, both the government and its citizens turned on minority Koreans. Within hours of the earthquake, rumors had begun to spread that Koreans were planning an uprising. They were said to be setting fires, poisoning wells, raping and looting. These messages spread as far as the island of Hokkaido, 500 miles to the north. Many citizens wasted no time responding. Vigilantes, called Jikeidan, armed mostly with makeshift weapons such as bamboo spears, carpentry tools, knives, and broken glass, attacked their Korean neighbors. On September 2nd, the newly installed prime minister declared martial law, moving troops into the affected region. Survivors tell of army units pulling Koreans off a train leaving the city and slaughtering them on the spot. At a minimum, police forces connived in the extermination. In some cases, they actively participated. They moved to round up Koreans and confined them. It was justified as protection and apprehension, though many of the people detained were then killed by vigilantes, in some cases inside police stations. Evidence shows that the government had an active role in spreading the misinformation. The Department of the Interior sent cables to its local branches saying that Koreans were committing arson and ordering them to be rounded up. Police reports from different precincts included claims that Koreans had sparked fires with bombs, that Koreans were poisoning wells, that 3,000 Koreans were looting and destroying Yokohama and coming for the capital next. The massacre went well beyond overzealous protection. Many of the Korean victims were tortured. Corpses were found dismembered, with eyes and noses cut out, thousands of lacerations, and genitals removed. Observer accounts suggest that such tortures were often inflicted before death. In one location, as the historian Sonia Ryong, herself a Korean who grew up in Japan, wrote, "The mob lined up children in front of parents and cut their throats. They then nailed parents to the wall by wrists and ankles and tortured them to death. The attacks took on the qualities of ritual sacrifice. By torturing the outsider, Japanese society could purge itself of the flaws that had engendered the earthquake." On the part of the government, officials may have been driven by other subconscious fears. Whether for having failed to heed Imamura's warnings or for disturbing the yin-yang balance, the blame could just as easily be laid at their own feet. Immigrant Koreans offered both a scapegoat and a diversion. That said, we cannot know if anyone in power explicitly fostered anti-Korean attacks to divert anger away from themselves. The government is itself individuals, people who had also lost their homes, witnessed the fires, felt the terror of uncertainty, panicked as their city was being destroyed around them. No one makes the best, most rational decisions in such a situation. Whatever their initial motivation, it was not until late on September 3rd that the police affairs bureaus notified news outlets that the previous reports of rebellion by the Koreans were unfounded. On September 4th, the police sent out notices that Koreans need not be attacked to protect the city, but the damage had already been done. By September 5th, 6,000 of the 20,000 Koreans living in Tokyo and Kanagawa had been tortured and murdered in what came to be called the Korean Massacre. At its core, the massacre was a particularly violent manifestation of our rejection of randomness, of our need, when the inexplicable strikes, for us to find and assign blame. That the responsibility was assigned to a minority population may reflect as much the national ambivalence about a new and changing world as it does human nature. Science had begun to undermine prevailing theories about the causation of natural disasters, but it hadn't yet offered a satisfying alternative to the traditional yin-yang view. It was the gulf between those two worldviews that allowed the denial and anger of grief to well up and, lacking another outlet, led government and citizens alike to victimize the most vulnerable among them. Chapter 6, When the Levee Breaks. Mississippi, United States, 1927. Mean old Levee taught me to weep and moan. Kansas Joe McCoy and Memphis Minnie, written in response to the 1927 floods. The Mississippi River is the great river of the United States. So great, in fact, that its scale can hardly be overstated. It has the third largest watershed in the world, gathering the rain and snow that fall on 32 American states, covering 40% of the territory of the United States, as well as two Canadian provinces. Its network of main stem and tributaries shuttles water to the Gulf of Mexico. Its Missouri River tributary is much longer than the main stem, but the more easterly branch was given the name Mississippi to more conveniently mark the boundary between English and Spanish territories. Long before the European territorialists assigned names, the Mississippi had been the larder and highway for the original settlers. Fish and mollusks were harvested from its waters, and trade flourished along its banks. The Europeans, when they came, were much more interested in the transportation potential of the river. When French explorer Sieur de La Salle claimed the river, he saw the potential to connect France's Gulf of Mexico settlements with Canada. But the French claim was never firm, and the Louisiana Purchase completed the transition of the river's control to America. Thousands of miles long, this massive body of water has always been both the soul and the bane of the people who live near it. It has been the economic engine for the agricultural and manufacturing boom of the central United States. The original industries of lumber and the fur trade shipped down the river to New Orleans and out to Europe. The great productive farms of the prairies that fed a nation and more were viable only with an efficient transportation system to take their products to our cities. Water power from the river ran the earliest manufacturing plants. The Mississippi became the visible symbol of the culture and lives within its region, flowing through books and songs from Mark Twain to Tennessee Williams, from Kansas Joe McCoy and Memphis Minnie to Stephen Foster to Allan Toussaint. But riverine flooding periodically takes back the economic bounty the river provides. The history of the Mississippi is a history of flooding. The story of the explorer Hernando de Soto in 1543, written by Inca Garcilaso de la Vega in the 16th century, includes an account of a 40-day flood of a Native American settlement near modern-day Memphis. The 19th century offers a chronicle of floods, great floods, and the great floods. The songs of the river, from Johnny Cash's 5 Feet High and Rising to Charlie Patton's High Water Everywhere, are songs of loss and death by the waters of the Mississippi. The success of European communities along the Mississippi has always, consequently, depended on the success of the levees around it. These embankments, both natural and artificial, help contain the river's periodic swelling, allowing life to resume as normal for the millions of residents along the Mississippi floodplains. Considering their crucial role in the area's existence, it is worth examining how natural and artificial levees form and function. To do so, we need to give up our illusion that there is an absolute boundary between water and land, between where the river flows and where it doesn't, and even between the fluid state of a river and the solid state of land. Because we live on land, we tend to make an existential distinction between what appears at the surface and what is submerged beneath our rivers, lakes, and oceans. But a river is not fundamentally different from the land around it. There is no distinction in the types of earth that form the riverbanks, nothing unique about the crust that lies beneath it. It is simply lower lying than the areas around it. Water flows down to wherever gravity pulls it, so inevitably, bodies of water form at those areas of lower elevation. This is stating the obvious, but it's a truth we tend to lose sight of. The Mississippi River is where it is because the land beneath it is at a lower elevation than nearly all the land surrounding it. In fact, for the last 450 miles of the Mississippi, the riverbed is actually below sea level. As it approaches New Orleans, the bed of the Mississippi is as low as 170 feet below sea level. The upper parts of the water continue downhill and with friction pull the rest of the water with them. It makes for a turbulent passage. The amount of water contained within a river fluctuates with rainfall. And because the Mississippi drains such a large area of land, its level is dependent on rain and snowfall in many different locations. The river can be seen not as a body of water confined between two distinct lines, but almost as a living thing that swells and shrinks. Those distinct lines on a map are the river only when it is in its shrunken state, in the calm between storms. The reality of a river is whatever land is needed to accommodate its flow. The second mind shift we need to make is to realize that a river is not just water. Moving water has the energy to carry many things within it. Naturally, the smaller and lighter the object, the easier it is to carry, and the faster the water is moving, the more it can propel. It's no accident that the Mississippi's nickname is the Big Muddy. Like all rivers, it picks up grains of sand and dirt with its motion, carrying them in suspension into the ocean. When the water slows down, it drops some of that sediment, with the bigger and heavier grains being deposited first. Putting these two ideas together, we see why natural levees appear. When water is channeled by gravity into a river, it often carries with it a lot of mud and silt. Rain and snow melt cause the water level to rise, such that the river is now at a higher elevation than the water ahead of it, which means it has farther to fall and the current increases, allowing it to carry even more silt. When the water level rises enough to overflow the riverbanks, it will continue to flow downhill, but now it is also doing so outwardly, along the surrounding land, and not just in a channel toward the ocean. No longer flowing as steeply downhill, it slows down, dropping its suspended grains of silt. The bigger grains fall first near the river, and the finer grained material ends up farther from the original riverbed. The result is a natural levee made up of the larger grains of sand, elevating the river's banks and rendering future floods less likely. But as the centuries of flooding in the Mississippi demonstrate, there is always a bigger surge of water ahead, one that can overcome the natural levee or even the artificial one. The people who have taken advantage of a levee, natural or artificial, to plant crops or build buildings in the floodplain, who have assumed the levee will always hold, or at least hold as long as they are living there, now face a startling reality. And when flooding strikes, it doesn't strike an area or its residents equally. New Orleans was the first attempt to create a European settlement within the floodplain of the Mississippi River. 14 city blocks were laid out in 1718 by Jean-Baptiste Lemoyne.